Okay, folks, we might make a start. Hope you've had an enjoyable lunch full of healthy treats and snacks and some stimulating conversation. Our first speaker is going to talk about empowering students to learn about air quality in their communities. Dr. Fabian Riesen, is that right? Riesen? Is a senior atmospheric research scientist in the Climate Science Centre of the CSIRO, Oceans and Atmosphere. Fabian's research focuses on biomass burning emissions and improving our understanding of the chemical composition of smoke plumes and how these impact on air quality and health. So the structure of these sessions is the same as the last ones, about 10 minutes for each speaker and then 10 minutes for questions at the end. Please welcome Fabian to the stage.
Thank you. So thank you very much. I'm very excited to present today a project that I've started on last year, and it talks about a hands-on STEM project. So instead of empowering communities, we decided how can we empower students to learn about air quality. So this project fits into a larger project that is funded by the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning. And so that project aim is to develop this real-time visual analysis tool, AQVX. And it's a system that provides real-time integrated data, including at looking at sort of where the smoke plumes actually go and how do they impact on communities. So this real-time system, it has sort of a number of data feeds that will feed into it. So some of the data that comes from remote sense data, so looking at satellite data. So now that we have a geostationary satellite, the Himawari satellite, we can actually get really up-to-date data on aerosol optical depths. We also looking at Sentinel data, so hotspot data. So Martine this morning, she presented one of the satellite images there. So that one gives us an idea where fire activity is going. And also we can sort of look from these geostationary satellites too. We get some really good indication on smoke plumes. We also looking at the Bureau of Meteorology radar data and also the now operational system by the Bureau of Meteorology is a smoke forecasting system, which has been developed by CSIRO, Bureau of Meteorology, and a number of universities in a previous project to look at how can we forecast particle concentrations due to planned burn events and also bushfires. We also integrating any of the EPA monitoring networks, so any of the air quality data from the EPA monitoring network. There's also an aerator smoke app that has been developed by University of Tasmania, looking at people's symptoms, so those ones can feed into the visual analysis tool as well, and if applicable, looking at some of the social media feeds. But what I'm going to focus on today is looking at those low-cost particle sensors and how we're going to use them to integrate into this visual analysis tool. So we've talked about today sort of where our PM monitoring network goes. So typically in previous years where we stood is just looking at this really high-quality instrumentation that provides high-quality data for compliance and regulation and also instrumentations that we use for research. Because they are high cost, this means that we can't really have that many instruments around, so the network is usually quite sparse. In recent years, there's been a paradigm shift, so we have all these new sensors sort of appearing at much lower cost. And what this means is that actually we can get more of those and sort of have a denser network of those. And these ones, they're sort of very amenable to sort of do community-based monitoring, but they can also be really interesting to fit into educational purposes as well. So why monitoring and STEM? So for us, we thought how better to engage with communities than via the education pathways. So we actually thought this is a great opportunity to engage with primary school and secondary school students and the teachers and give them the opportunity to learn about air quality, to learn about how they can operate, program, and analyze air quality data set. So the objective of this particular STEM project is to look at specifically at the issue of smoke impacts on air quality using these low-cost sensors. And so we've developed a curriculum to work around this. So the curriculum is focused on five major lessons. So in the first lessons, we sort of go over general air pollution issues, what are the major pollutants, and then we go on to particle pollution. And the reason we go into particles is that, as was mentioned this morning, particles are a major component of smoke, and they also it's a major component that's also primarily exceeding air quality guidelines. So it's one that we know has been linked to health impacts. So then in lesson two, we focus a bit more on biomass burning to teach the students sort of what happens during when we have smoke going up into the air, what is smoke composed of, what are the conditions, why do we actually get the smoke, and then get an understanding of sort of what conditions actually produce more particles compared to others. Lesson three, then, we go over the different how we measure particles in the air. So this one really gives students a better understanding of what instrumentation is available and what is the data information and the data quality that I can get from these different instruments. So going anywhere from the really high-quality instrumentation that are currently used in EPA monitoring stations all the way down to the particle sensors that can be commercially available. In lesson four, then, we work with the students so that they can build their own smoke observation gadget, and I'm going to present that one in the slides further on. And they can use that little sensor kit then to monitor the air quality in the area. And in the final lessons, then, we go over the data sets to sort of process the data, analyze it, and do the interpretation of what does it actually mean. So what do the students get out of it? So they get an idea, how does smoke affect us? In terms of looking at your health, in terms of visibility, in terms of do I smell the smoke. They also get a better understanding what actually happens in the fire. Why do I create smoke and why is it detrimental to my health? As I mentioned, understanding on how ambient particles are measured. The other important thing is, too, the principles of scientific monitoring. So really going over with the students, what's the instruments, what data quality can we expect from different instruments, how do we actually do data quality assurance and data quality control. And then do the interpretation of the data sets. So we have these data sets that now comes out. What does it actually mean? So we work in close collaborations with the CSR Education and Outreach Program to see how does this STEM activity actually fit into the Australian curriculum. So we looked at different areas within the Australian curriculum where it actually could fit into. And so we saw the STEM activity fits nicely within the science, mathematics, digital technologies, and also geography. So looking at all these different areas and sort of what's in the curriculum, we decided that it was this STEM activity is particularly a good fit for grade 6 up to grade 8 students. So the major thing that they would learn is actually process a real-time data set that they're actually going to collect, and then they're going to look at it and then do their own interpretation to try to get an understanding, what does this mean for me? Also, what's quite interesting, because this one is linked, so usually, as Jason mentioned this morning, you can get your cheap sensors, but then you have to understand, how do I get my data off from it? So it's sort of learning their programming skills as well. Can I write a Python code to get the instrument actually talking to my computer and actually get data out of it? So the key components of the units that we build, so there are two commercially available sensors. One is a particle dust sensor, you can see on the top, and the other one is a temperature and relative humidity sensor. So if we've seen this morning, since these sensors are quite sensitive to temperature and humidity, we thought it's good to introduce temperature and humidity sensor in as well to make sense sort of if you get some weird sort of discrepancies between different monitors to understand why this happens. It's linked to a Raspberry Pi, which we use as a microcontroller via a printed circuit board. Then we have additional components too. So we actually have a base plate, which makes it much easier then for students to mount the various components into the unit. And then all this one fits nicely in a waterproof enclosure. This is an image of when the whole unit is assembled. So the printed circuit board has nicely connectors on there, so it's easy to connect the different sensors and the battery to it. The Raspberry Pi, so it has its SD card, so we have our whole programming code on there. All the data gets saved on it, but additional data also gets saved onto a USB stick that the students then can use to analyze the data. And on the right-hand side, you can sort of see how the units can be deployed outdoors. So the printed circuit board, in addition to have the connectors, also have 5 LED lights. And these ones are initially for showing the students during the initialization phase whether there's any sort of status errors. So if any of these ones, sensors aren't connected properly, the lights turn red and pretty much the program doesn't continue. It just stays in this phase until the problem is fixed. So once all the sensors are properly connected, shows green, and then it moves into the monitoring phase. And during the monitoring phase, we use these LED lights to provide some interactive monitoring. So it just gives the students immediately an idea, what's the particle pollution like in my area? So these are updated every time there's a data point coming through, so this sensor about every 5 seconds, say, shoot out a data point. So for these examples, I look at green lights, 1 to 5, show pretty low particle concentrations. Once it moves to yellow, you have sort of moderate. And once it gets to the red light, it pretty much shows, well, we have some high particle concentrations in the area. So we've done a trial at a primary school in Melbourne last year where we ran the whole curriculum through it just to get sort of an idea how well it worked. It was great to have the positive feedback from the students. They were really engaged. Also, the teacher was quite happy, and as well the school principal. So we had some really great interactions with the students through the whole curriculum. And the students also, they're trying to really personalize their own smoke units as well. We also done an in-comparison study at Espinosa, so we had 30 units what you had so far. We just set them up against our other instrumentation to see how well they compared against gravimetric mass measurements. And we also had the units out this year in May, June, up in Northeast Victoria, where we deployed them after sort of some burning events up there. So all these ones, these deployments enabled us to get a better assessment how these units actually work. And we are really pleased with it. So when we did the inter-comparison study, so the units compare against each other really well, so units correlate really well. So we know that if you have one unit that looks a bit odd against, and we have one right in the same area, it could actually be there's an issue with the unit. But in general, having them all together, they perform really well. We also had the units running against one of mass-corrected measurements. So in blue, that's the mass-corrected measurements, and in black, it's our little smog unit. And as you can see overall, it overpredicts, which is pretty typical what we observe with optical instrumentation. So at these concentrations, usually we see an overprediction. What we can see is that the variability in PM2.5 concentrations are really well captured. So they're really happy to see that if a plume event occurs, they actually capture it really well. And also what we see at really high concentrations, they seem to drop off. So we have to take that one into consideration, that these ones aren't absolute data points that we necessarily get, but we really manage to capture the smoke plume events quite well. And once we get a better idea how they perform, we can actually correct for these validations. So for future, we're planning to do the school deployment for these units in term 1 and 2 of 2019. So in discussion with staff, sort of where we should deploy them, so we have chosen two school regions. So one of it is the Trobe Valley, so we can link into the EPA Citizen Science Program. And we also, based on sort of prescribed burns that are conducted and really great citizen engagement, we also decided to do Anglesey. We also will add remote communication capability, so we can actually track the observed PM2.5 concentration in real time and then link it into the air quality visual analysis tool. And hopefully, once the project finishes in June, future plans are hopefully to expand this STEM activity into other regions in Victoria and hopefully also to other states. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. That was really great. What an amazing program to run. Thank you. Our next speaker is going to talk to you about La Trobe Valley Monitoring and Citizen Science. Emma Saville is a science communication advisor at EPA. Emma has a translator of complex scientific information to all Victorians. Very pleased I'm in this presentation. Thank you. And she's currently working to deliver meaningful data, information and education to the Trobe Valley community. Welcome, Emma, while I get her presentation up.
Alrighty. The La Trobe Valley is a hot topic at the moment. It seems like every session is talked about it, so I'll jump right in. So on the 9th of February 2014, Victoria was facing the most extreme bushfire conditions since Black Saturday. The Hazelwood mine fire that began on this day was the largest and longest burning mine fire that has occurred in the La Trobe Valley to date. The fire was caused by embers spotting into the mine from a bushfire burning nearby. Almost half of the mine caught fire, and to put that into perspective, the mine perimeter is about 18 kilometres, and the perimeter of the MCG oval is less than 500 metres. So it's a pretty big mine, pretty big area to catch fire. The mine fire burned for 45 days and sent smoke and ash over the town of Morwell for much of this time. EPA provided air quality monitoring and forecasting services throughout the fire, but the information wasn't being easily transmitted or understood by community. So extreme bushfire conditions like those experienced in 2014 are happening with increasing severity and frequency, and this could happen again. The impact of the Hazelwood mine fire on the Latrobe Valley community has been significant. The impacts have been the subjects of separate government inquiries, as well as a long-term health study currently being run by Monash University called the Hazelwood Health Study. EPA took a lead role in the Hazelwood mine fire in terms of helping community understand the potential impacts from the mine fire, and we've continued to keep the community front of mind in our recovery efforts. EPA started this recovery effort by producing forecasts and better understanding air quality in Latrobe Valley, talking and listening to the community, being part of working groups with other agencies, and starting a citizen science program. But the community told us that this wasn't enough. They wanted more safeguards against potential health impacts from an incident in the future. The science said we could remove the four additional monitoring stations that were put in place during the mine fire and just return to the one monitoring station at Traralgon, but the community disagreed, so we asked them what they did want. EPA committed to implementing the changes to air monitoring in Latrobe Valley in line with these community requests. But to do this, we needed a community panel and we needed a remit, as you can see behind me. So the community are the best people to design an air monitoring network that best suits them. The panel designed an air monitoring network in a similar way to us all here designing an air quality strategy. You as Victorians are the people best placed to decide the priorities for air quality into the future, just like our Latrobe Valley community panel. So our Latrobe Valley community panel was chosen to be as diverse as possible. A third of participants were known community members who we asked to take part because they have their finger on the pulse of the valley. And one third were self-nominated from advertising, and one third were randomly selected from a mail-out match to a demographic representation of the Latrobe Valley community. So we accounted for geographical age and demographics, gender distribution as best we could, and the majority of the panel knew nothing about air quality monitoring or equipment before this all started. EPA was there to provide information and to answer any questions, but otherwise the decision-making left largely to them. There were three sessions held to design this air monitoring network in 2016. In session one was air quality monitoring basics, where everyone got a crash course in particulate matter, air quality and equipment. Session two was starting to co-design the network with maps and coloured markers. So participants mapped out some scenarios and thought about what changes they might like to make to the air quality network within a set budget. You can see one of our comparison charts. So session three, everyone came to a consensus on the type of air monitoring network they wanted and the locations and types of sensors. It was important that everyone involved was happy with what they designed. It was designed by the community for the community. We've held follow-up sessions. We've sent out regular newsletters to our panel since to keep them informed in the progress of implementing the network and ask them if any changes we've had to make are okay. I don't see any panel members here. I know there was a few, but if you see any, thanks. Got a nice video too.
This stuff is completely different. It's a completely different way of doing business for us. And what we would normally do when we want to design a new network, monitoring network, is we get all the information we have and we design it ourselves. This time, we decided to flip it completely and bring the community in the room and co-design the entire thing. The information that people really want to know about their air quality will be embedded in that design.
All that has to come out of this process is for there to be a successful monitoring system for Latrobe Valley that will act as the canary in the mine to alert us when there is a problem.
I want to make sure that my family's going to grow up somewhere that's safe and healthy.
Some sort of safety, some sort of way that the community can look at the information and it makes sense to them.
When you work with a community, genuinely work with a community pays you back with trust.
I certainly I've got a different view of the NPI than I had 10 years ago, and I'd like to change things.
If 2 years ago I could have imagined a process, right, that involved the community and the EPA and had a budget, it would have been this.
So, the community designed a warning system for smoke that will let them keep them and their families safe in the event of an incident. This includes 14 smoke sensors, 8 low-cost gas sensors, 3 air quality cameras, and 3 higher quality particulate monitors. This takes the total number of sites from 5 to 24 and added some more instruments to existing stations. Using their local knowledge of the area, this network covers a broad range of the valley. And this is what the network looks like in practice. The orange sites are existing EPA monitoring stations. The dark blue are new monitoring and sensor locations. And the greeny-teal are industry-owned monitoring locations that the panel have asked us to get information from. We're currently working through the nitty-gritty technical details of that now. So the smoke sensors that make up the bulk of the network have been installed as of last week. We're making sure that they're performing well and will meet community expectations, and we'll meet up with our community panel again in a couple of weeks to look at the data and make sure that it makes sense and that it's useful. The image of the map is from our test website. It's not live yet. So implementing this network has not been without its challenges. Even now we're working through some issues with the suppliers, with the sensors we installed last week. The community have been rightfully frustrated at how long this has taken us. This is new ground for EPA, and we haven't moved as quickly as we thought we could. The data, we've recently done some user research that shows Victorians perceive the data collected by EPA to be trustworthy and accurate. So it's important that the data that we're providing is as accurate and fit for purpose as possible. I know I trust the Bureau of Meteorology data to be the most accurate weather information, even if I know that weather forecasts are often wrong. So as another government department, we should expect our data is held in that same regard, especially as people use our data to make decisions about their health. The sensors are new technology for EPA, and we have a duty to make sure we're not putting untested equipment or equipment we're not comfortable with into the public sphere. During our trials, we discovered some limitations to the sensors and that we wanted to work through to make sure we're giving the community the useful sensor network they asked for, not just a sensor network that may not actually be of any use. The community asked for a warning system for an incident, and we wanted to make sure we give them what they designed. So what's next? Some feedback from the co-design sessions. There was a lot of things about particulate matter in the Latrobe Valley that nobody really knows anything about. Our data indicates that there are likely to be many sources of PM2.5 in the valley. This includes industry as well as biomass burning, like controlled burns, bushfires, and domestic wood heaters. We're purchasing an atholometer to better understand PM2.5 in the Latrobe Valley. So an atholometer is an instrument which measures the black carbon content of particles. So that should help us tell the difference between combustion sources of PM2.5, like controlled burns and bushfires, domestic wood heaters, industry, and other sources of PM2.5. We're also running a citizen science project at the moment to determine the sources of dust and PM10 in the Latrobe Valley and the impact they might have on indoor air quality. So the community co-designed that question based on their interests, and at the moment they're co-designing the sampling methodology based on their local knowledge of the area. And we're going to reconvene with our air monitoring co-design panel in a couple of weeks and then again in 6 months to co-interpret the data we get from the sensor network trial. The community are the best placed people to determine what could have caused certain spikes in data or talk about certain sources, and we couldn't do it without them. Thank you.
Thanks, Emma, for sharing that really fantastic initiative. Obviously, wasn't born out of the greatest circumstances, but it's really good to see you working so closely with the community there, so thank you. Our last speaker for today is going to talk about the application of low-cost sensing technologies for air quality monitoring and exposure assessments. How far have they gone? Linda Morawski, is a professor at the Queensland University of Technology, the director of International Laboratory for Air Quality and Health at QUT, which is a collaborating centre of the World Health Organisation and a co-director of the Australian-China Centre for Air Quality Science and Management. Welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. I guess we may be tired of listening about sensors. There's been so much about the sensors, I didn't expect that my presentation will be one of the many and after the many about sensors. Hopefully this will be a little bit different focus. Very briefly, I'll talk about a few aspects. Low-cost sensors paradigm change, what new information will they provide, are they performing, utilization of the data, sensors network around the world, and future. What is a low-cost sensors? After all what we've heard today, we probably have a very good idea. Well, is it just a cost? One important aspect is sensors should be cheap enough to be replaced rather than fixed when they fail. Something which costs several thousand dollars is not a sensor. And perhaps the most important, the last point, whether they perform or not is concluded on statistical basis in relation to the field of data, not on the necessary on the individual sensor. So this little bottom part paradigm change in air quality monitoring is not just about putting more devices, but very different way of looking at the monitoring. Now, this looking statistical basis, we are talking about machine learning programs which need to be employed. Why do we want to use low-cost sensors? I guess after all the presentations today, we have a pretty good idea about this to better understand spatial variation in pollutant concentrations, and we can go very detailed city scale block, source contribution indoor and outdoor, which current system can do, personal exposure, and the community queries, local areas, and that's very much also the interest of the government. Now, in Australia, we've heard a lot what's been happening, particularly in Victoria. There's one big project in which a number of states is involved. The project is supported by the Australian Research Council, and its title is Developing and Utilising Advanced Networks of Air Quality Sensing and Analysis. So the project is at the beginning of its second year. It's administered by QUT, and we've got some partners here in this project from South Australia, from Victoria, I think. I don't know if somebody from New South Wales is here. So we have sensor networks operating in Brisbane, Sydney, at the Gold Coast, and currently we are talking about networks in Melbourne, Adelaide, and also Wollongong. But as we've heard, there are several other projects in Australia as well. Whether smaller or bigger, it's not necessarily the best formulation of the question. The sensors which we've developed, or the monitors which we've developed, are called Koala. There was a lot of discussion about how to call these monitors. And most of the commercially available monitors had something to do with the air in the name. So we thought we'll use a very different name. And, well, the name stuck and everybody calls them now Koala. The first application of network of Koalas were for the Commonwealth Games in April at the Gold Coast. And actually this drove the project in this direction because rather than going step by step, we had to go all the way until through the developing of the technology, developing of the data management center, which is in the Amazon Web Services, and visualization, which would be useful for the community and everybody involved. So here you've got two koalas on the, I think this was the Aslitz village. The network as such, or in its whole entity, doesn't exist because the Aslitz village doesn't exist. But one important aspect was that there was a local school involved in this activity, and the sensor, the koalas at the school still stayed after the activity, and the map is still available. So this was the visualization at the time. The sensors, as I said, are being deployed in several the networks in several places within Australia, but they are operating and will be operating overseas as well. What's not necessarily very clear where this is at the roof of the Chinese Research Academy of Environmental Sciences in Beijing. And so we've got them there operating. In about 2 months, they will be also deployed to Suva in Fiji. Now, when talking about the networks of sensors here, we've talked about several of them, 10 and so on. Now, to put things in perspective, in China, apparently, there are of the order of 30,000 sensors operating. In Beijing, along 1,500 sensors operating by the municipal Beijing Municipal Environmental Monitoring Center. In city of Jinan, 200 sensors traveling on taxis. Now, how this information from the sensors is used is very difficult to tell because nothing is published or available on the on any website. We are now working with our colleagues from China to sort of put some kind of, not very detailed, but at least some information about how the information is used. But with our during our meeting in April with these guys from that Beijing Monitoring Center, it appeared that they've got the whole, not only the sensors operating, but they've got the whole machine learning system in place to be able to use the data. So this sounded very impressive. On the other hand, with the taxis in Jinan, there are some display of the concentrations along different routes, but there's still not very clear idea how this data could be used apart from looking at the data. Another international initiative developing a global platform on air quality and health. This is an activity of the World Health Organization to generate better data on air pollution-related diseases and strengthen support to countries and cities through guidance, information, and so on. This activity started in 2014, and initially the WHO and the whole group was looking into ground-based data to be included, satellite and transport model. There was some mention of sensors, but nobody really thought about this seriously. The situation has changed significantly, and in the following meetings in Geneva in 2015 and last year in Madrid, sensor data will fully be incorporated. There will be a global WHO conference in October in Geneva, and I'm running a session of sensors, inclusion of sessions in the in sensors in the global platform. So are there any challenges still for before this new paradigm becomes the reality? Is the technology a challenge? We've heard different views about the technology, and somebody said that maybe in 5 years they will be ready. Well, I'd say that the technology is not only maturing, but it's already here and available. We've tested quite a range of sensors, and I'm talking here about PM2.5 sensor or PM sensors. And this is a statement from the paper that we demonstrated that when tested appropriately and used with a full understanding of their capabilities limitations, they have to be used with understanding. Without this, it's not going to work. Low-cost sensors can be an unprecedented aid in a wide range of applications. So the technology, I believe, is here. But in the main challenges are somewhere else. And it is how to sustain operation of sensor networks, and in particular, how to use the data. This is where the discussion is shifting, how to use the data. The title of my presentation is basically the same as the paper which we recently published in Environment International, where we reviewed basically everything which was available about application of low-cost sensors, but the whole process, so from the technology to utilization of the data. So this map shows some of the largest projects. Eventually, in the second part of the paper, we focus mainly on the largest projects. So these are the largest projects, and these are government funded projects. So this would be directly like the US EPA's project or competitive grants like in the European Union. So we can see here the past projects and the current projects. Now, what came very interesting and very, surprising from this review, that while this project, government funding, project funded by government funding, had its life and finished at the end of the project with some number of papers published, information presented, but there wasn't really much left after the project. Which project seemed to survive time, crowdfunding, and commercial projects? And there are several projects like this which have been operating now for many years. But there is a catch to this. One of the biggest projects, Air Vision and Purple Air, which have thousands of sensors around the world, we also bought some sensors from this project to see how they operate. What they present on the data is a mix of indoor and outdoor data. Again, it is how to use the information. So what really is the niche for the sensors? How much more information will be obtained from tens of thousands of sensors compared to high-resolution satellite data? Maybe wearable sensors to account for indoor exposure and behaviors are more important to raise awareness? There's no one answer to these questions. There are many different applications, and it all depends on the needs, on the specific area, specific problems. So in summary, there has been a huge interest and a lot of work conducted to explore low-cost sensors, but the majority of the work so far has been published and available on the technology itself, and these questions are asked, is the technology right? The technology, I believe, is right. The next step is to move from the concept that they can be applied and used to the information flow, so sustained operation of the sensor networks or focus campaign. Sometimes we just need a focus campaign. This is really still to happen and been happening. But from what I've seen so far, so whether we first define the question to be addressed by the application of low-cost sensors or just go ahead and deploy a network of sensors, there is a huge benefit and information improvement which drives change and improvement in air quality. Thank you.
Thank you. I have to say, I'm a convert. You can never have too many presentations on sensors. It's amazing. Thank you. If I just invite our two previous speakers up. We're going to go for a little bit longer. Probably got another 5 or 6 minutes. Is there any questions for the panel? Gentleman here.
Good question for Emma. The citizen science monitoring network doesn't necessarily protect the local residents. It warns them when to evacuate.
Maybe not so much when to evacuate, but when to evacuate the health plan.
Yeah, my question is, does the EPA have the power to force open cut coal mines to remediate when they're finished? So we don't have another coal plant.
That is certainly not a question for me. That would be a question for someone.
But it would protect the atmosphere.
It may do, but I certainly don't have the answer for that.
Gentleman here.
I have a question about the community co-design panel. You presented that in the beginning. The panel met a few times to educate him. What was the frequency of panel meetings to this point? Like, did they meet regularly, like every few months, or what? How did you keep the panel basically interested and engaged throughout the process? That's
my question. Absolutely. So the panel first met in 2016. Mm-hmm. They would meet every 6 weeks. And since then, we've had about 2 meetings with them to look at the progress we've made, have a look at our sensor network trials, and we've got another one in 2 weeks, but we send out monthly newsletters with any updates and any other interesting relevant value news that they might be interested in.
Someone here?
Yeah, I've got a question for Emma as well. So what's the budget for the community monitoring that you put in for Trobelli? And how do I get one in my own community? Or do I have to have a major catastrophe?
You know, off the top of my head, I do not know the budget, but it wasn't small.
Roughly, if it wasn't small.
Steve, do you know?
When you're using about 300,000 or 300,000.
Yeah. Let a network if you don't...
Maribyrnong Truck Action Group in terms of pollution from diesel trucks in the city of Maribyrnong? Absolutely, we're interested.
No. The lady here.
Oh, hi, my question's for Emma's father. You mentioned there's a good perception of the trustworthiness of the EPA monitoring. Was that before or after the VAGO report on the EPA monitoring? Do you know, did that have any impact on the public perception of the accuracy of the EPA monitoring?
I'm not quite sure if the VAGO report had any impact on the Latrobe Valley's perception of us. That was all through a lot of community work and a lot of on the ground work, but it may have done. I would assume it was all of the work that we've done face to face with people.
Yeah, how was the perception measured?
How was the perception measured? Before the or just after the fire, everyone was very distrustful of EPA. Our response during the fire wasn't great. The response intergovernmental wasn't great. So after the fire, we put in a lot of groundwork, and people went from being our biggest detractors to some of our biggest allies. And really,
was there like a survey or something? Or?
We did some surveys, before and after the co-design that showed people had really turned around.
I have a question for Fabian. Give him a break. really interesting to hear about the students' involvement with the sensors, and it sounds like a great project. My questions, you may or may not know the answer, it relates to your bio being having an understanding of chemical composition of smoke plumes, and I was wondering if the sensors or your other work has involved looking at the post-logging burns, because they're different to the other planned burns that the government does. They have these propellants, a little bit napalm-like, intense sort of propellants used to start the fires, and then the plumes are very, very different because it's large, very dense biomass that's burning. So I was just wondering if you could give us some indication about those chemicals, the composition of the chemicals that's going out, I suppose in April of this year, the intense fires in the Central Highlands that a lot of the smoke haze that we had in Melbourne in that time was attributed to those fires.
Yeah. So when we're looking at sort of smoke composition, we're sort of looking at different components, sort of how efficiently it gets burned. So depending on how you need to measure it, especially for the really high intensity burns, it's going to be really difficult unless you sort of do smoke plumes, you capture the smoke plumes sort of close by. So I've done a lot of work on low intensity prescribed burns, because there we can get really close by. We can actually do measurements during the intense flaming combustion. So we sort of compare the flaming combustions versus the smoldering one. We sort of already get there the difference. So we definitely have sort of, depending on how the smoldering combustion works, we have sort of an increased particle emissions. So we're trying to focus on that. But for example, the high intensity one, it's much more difficult to really capture the smoke. I think the smoke composition itself is probably going to be quite similar. I don't know about any of whether the chemicals that they use to sort of accelerate them. I've never seen it. And I don't really know if there's any chemicals there that afterwards would sort of show up in the flues. But it would be more challenging. You almost have to be really know where you're going downwind to see whether it has an impact. Or otherwise, you almost have to have sort of some aircraft measurements that can actually capture the flues. Or some, maybe now with some drone technology might be able to sort of look into it. But yeah, it isn't something that we haven't been able to look at.
Thanks. Was there another question? Not right? No? Lady with the glasses, sorry.
Congratulations for trying to transform the next generation with a project. My question for you is, the group that I'm part of, the community group, is about equitable facilities and resources.
Yep.
So with this, once the pilot's finished in early next year, will it be back on the schools to pay for it, or will the pricing of the project that rollouts will be funded by government and CSIRO?
Well, that one we haven't really worked through it yet, so that's sort of the next phase. I'm trying to get the project, but I know we have sort of in discussions as well whether CSO Education would be able, whether they have some funding that they could use for some of the schools to help out. So whether through that. But yeah, that's still in discussions. But hopefully, yeah, there might be some possibility that sort of there's some other type of funding that would come through to sort of get other schools sort of who don't have the money to still get them involved.
And the last question here.
Fabian again. How do we best get our schools involved? And is it applicable for, are you looking at from grade 5 to 6 or are you more 7 onwards?
So I've done the pilot study in grade 6 and that was sort of based on that, yeah, they then have sort of some understanding about sort of some of the science or to be able to sort of do data processing. And so it's really depending. I think it worked quite well, but I think even grade 7 and 8 it would be quite adaptable because we can sort of change what they can do. So at the moment, for the data processing, we develop macros so they could be adapted, that they could be really simple, that they immediately show a graph that students can work off, or they can do their own processing. So it sort of can be adapted across. So hopefully once the project finishes, so we're still in discussion sort of what's the afterlife of this project, and sort of who's then sort of, whether it's the SR education or whether it's the other sort of, we're still trying to figure out who's going to take it on board. But yeah, I'm happy to sort of give me context. Just to sort of let you know what sort of the future is going to be for the STEM project.
Thank you. Thank you to our panel. Thanks certainly for the questions. I think a lot of what's been talked about today is the kind of in this session is the perfect segue into our next session in next door, which is really about looking at the actions to contribute to achieving the objectives that you set this morning. So thanks once again to the panel. Thanks to you for the questions as well.